Thank you, Sandra, and musicians. Thank you, and everybody, for being here. So, From Science to God, I chose that title for my book, and Sandra chose it for today. There's two meanings in it for me. Personally, there's my own journey of somebody who started out as a scientist with no interest whatsoever in religion. I had no interest whatsoever. In fact, I rejected religion when I was about 12, 13. I was brought up regular Protestant Church of England, and we sort of went to church once a month because it was thought that was probably good enough to wash away our sins. Minimal attendance, but you know, we all dutifully went. And I got to the stage of going through confirmation, and you know, apart from them telling you all about the facts of life, all that stuff, I realized the Nicene Creed was something you were meant to believe in. You know, I believe in one God, and blah, 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 and all that stuff. And I thought it was just something you chanted in church. And I realized actually to be a full member of the church, I had to believe in that stuff. And I just thought, no way can I actually believe in it. I can't sign off on that stuff. It's a nice, you know, just religious stuff. So that's when I rejected religion and told my parents I wasn't going to church anymore and didn't. Until I started speaking at churches 40 years later. What shifted was actually my studies in physics. I loved physics. I still love physics. I still keep up my reading in physics. But I realized, however much scientists, physicists understood about the physical world, the material world, there was nothing in physics that explained why we were conscious. We might understand everything about the brain, how the brain works, all of that. We don't yet. We're a long, long way off. But maybe in 100 years' time, 50 years' time, we may understand what goes on in the brain. But why does any of that give rise to a conscious experience? And it struck me that physics could probably explain everything ultimately about how the world works, from atoms to galaxies and everything in between. The one thing it can't answer is why we're conscious. Why do we ever have a single thought, a conscious experience? Why does all that functioning that goes on in the brain ever give rise to an experience? And that was the challenge that I was faced with in my own studies. And so, in the end, I thought this was more important. The mind, understanding the mind, was the fascinating thing for me. And, in a way, everything that physics knows is in the mind. We talk about consciousness being fundamental. It was also clear that, you know, physics is just all in the mind. It's just ideas, it's theories, it's concepts, equations. It's all in the mind. Everything we know is in the mind. Our experience right now is in the mind. The mind is all we actually know. It's absolutely fundamental. So science couldn't possibly exist without mind. And yet there's nothing in science to explain mind. This struck me as a very strange sort of paradox. And science wasn't interested in it either. Science was only interested in what it knew. It wasn't interested in the process of knowing. It completely sort of cut that off and left that aside, which again struck me as pretty strange. It really goes back to Descartes. Descartes, 350 years ago, was sort of the beginning of science. He made this distinction. He said there's the things we can experience, the things that exist in space and time, and there's the world of the mind. And he said, us, they weren't called scientists then, they called themselves natural philosophers. We natural philosophers will study the world of space and time, and the world of the mind will lead to the church. And he did that for self-preservation, because he'd already seen Bruno burnt at the stake for contradicting the church, and Galileo being put under house arrest for contradicting the church. The last thing he wanted to do was get caught up with the Inquisition and all that stuff. So he said, you can look at the mind, we'll look at the physical world. And that's the way it's been since then. Science has looked at the physical world, the mind is left aside. Although now it's beginning to take an interest in mind and consciousness, partly because of things that are happening in modern physics, with the observer effect, but more because of all the research that's going on today into the neurophysiology is raising this question of how does all that activity in the brain ever give rise to conscious experience, to the mind, to what we know? And that's seemed to be the great hard question. And that's what took me out of physics, realizing that physics was never going to answer the real fundamental and fascinating problems, which were all about consciousness for me. So I left physics. I thought I might study philosophy. I thought that might help me. I mean, philosophy is literally the study of wisdom, philosophia. That's what it means, the study of wisdom. And I thought, maybe philosophy will have it. And I looked at doing the philosophy curriculum. I was at Cambridge in England at the time, and I realized the philosophy was just the study of dead philosophers. It wasn't doing philosophy. This is what Plato said, this is what Kant said, this is what Wittgenstein said, and you know, you compare them all. It wasn't actually doing it. So I decided to do psychology, experimental psychology, which is the study of the brain. I thought maybe if I really understood the brain in more detail, this might help. So I did a degree in psychology, and I understood a lot about the brain. I don't think the word consciousness was really mentioned once in the whole degree program. They were interested in the brain, but not in experience. They talk about experience in terms of doing experiments, you know, what color do you see, and how, you know, short-term memory would be experiential, but they weren't interested in consciousness itself. But by this time, I'd started getting interested in Eastern thought, and I started exploring meditation as a way of understanding the mind. It struck me the people who really understood consciousness were the people who looked at it firsthand. And the only way you can really look at consciousness is firsthand, which is looking inside yourself. We are conscious beings. We all have minds. The way we explore consciousness is to look inside and look at our own minds. And that's what all the great mystics, yogis, spiritual adepts, saints, throughout history, in all cultures, have done. They sat down and observed their own mind, not observing the physical world, which the physical scientists do, but observing mind itself, watching the mind, noticing how the mind functions, looking for how things arise in the mind. And those people, I would say, are scientists. And this to me is perhaps another sort of angle on the science of mind. Because science is, to put it in its simplest form, science is just the careful observation of the natural world in order to arrive at some sort of consensus understanding. And so in the physical sciences, you observe the world, you do experiments, you draw conclusions, you publish them in journals, and people debate, and they see what they agree upon, and gradually this body of knowledge moves forward. You can do exactly the same thing in the mind. You know, we can do experiments. We can have not done formally the same way, we can have a hypothesis that if I sit down and focus my attention in a certain way on the heart or the breath, then this might have a certain result on my consciousness, and we do it. And if many people find it does, then we sort of get a body of knowledge arising about how the mind works. And to me, this whole body of knowledge is what we see in the spiritual literature the world over. All of that literature comes originally from people who explored their own consciousness or had experiences which took them deeper into consciousness, into that whole realm. And then what happened, I think, through their realizations, what people find when they go deep within is First of all, there's a quality of peace there, a deep sense of peace, a deep sense of ease. I sometimes find the best word for it is okayness. It's not a normal word, but that's the best word I've come up with. It's okayness. When you go deep within, it's like, it's that sense of relief. It's okay. That's what you get in deep meditation. It's like, don't have to worry about the present. There may be things about the future you need to worry about, but the present is what it is. And I think this is the universal discovery of the mystics, is that there's a deep, deep sense of ease when you connect into the present moment. What happens in our culture is we are so busy looking outside for that the whole time. We look to get things, get the world be a certain way, thinking if we could just have things be right, we'd feel okay, we'd feel at peace. So we're looking to feel okay inside by doing things out there. And that's what runs our world and is running it towards disaster. And I think what all the great spiritual teachings say, what they've all realized through this thing of inner exploration, direct experience, is no, it's not like that. Whether you're at peace or not isn't to do with what goes on out there. It's to do with how you see things, or to put it more technically, your frame of reference, the lens you're looking through, your interpretation. An example I often use when I'm working in the corporate field, because it seems to get home to them pretty quickly, is I ask people, you know, how many people get stressed in a traffic jam? And most people will put up their hands and say, yes, traffic jams make me stressed. I then point out this is absolutely not true at all. You may feel stressed, but if you're sitting in a traffic jam, it's actually the least stressful part of driving. A busy freeway at 70 miles an hour is far more stressful than sitting in a traffic jam. But you don't feel stressed when you're driving down the freeway, you do in a traffic jam. Why? And the why is there's the voice in your head is ticking away, that inner dialogue which is chatting away so much, telling you what's going on, what should be happening, what shouldn't be happening, and it starts going on. I'm going to be late, I'm going to be, how late am I going to be, and if this happens, you know, wherever it is I'm going, I'm going to miss the appointment, or I'm going to be late home, and the kids are going to be blah, 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 blah. You start creating stress. Somebody else could be sitting in exactly the same traffic jam. And they could be saying, this is wonderful. This is the sort of situation I've been wishing for all day long. I've got nobody coming in with problems to solve, no computers beeping at me. We probably will have soon. But I can sit back and relax. The point is, exactly the same environment, same situation, two totally different inner reactions. It's how you see things that's critical. And this, I think, is what spiritual adepts have discovered time and time and time again. And it's one of those things that is there underneath just about every single spiritual tradition. It's the essence of Buddhism. Buddha's realization was, and the way it's often put loosely is, we all suffer. That's misinterpreted. What he saw was, we are all discontent. The real meaning of the word dukkha in Buddhism is not suffering, it's discontent. We are not able to just be content with what is in the moment. And he says that discontent comes from wanting things to be different. We start wanting this, not wanting that, we want to get rid of this, but we want things to be different. So we create a sense of discontent. And the natural state of the mind is this state of ease and peace. We disturb it by telling ourselves it's not okay, we're missing something. And our whole culture, advertising the whole time, is telling you there's something missing, you can't be happy, you've got to have this. Our whole culture is telling us, be discontent. You cannot be content with things. You need more. And the spiritual teachings have always expressed the opposite to that. I think, I mean, I see the same thing in Christian teachings, the idea, the sign that you often see painted outside churches, not this sort of church, but sort of the more fundamentalist churches, sinners repent because the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Okay, you've seen that, or you heard that quoted. You look, what does that actually mean? The word sin, if you go back to the Greek, is amatoia, which is an archery term, which means to miss the center of the target in archery. So a sinner is somebody who's missed the center of the target. What is the center of the target? What is it we are all aiming for? Ultimately, I think what we all want is we want to feel okay. We want that peace of mind. We can call it different things. Some people call it happiness, peace of mind, relief. None of us want to be in pain, to suffer. So that's what we're all aiming for. So a sinner is someone who's aiming for that, wants to be at peace, but is missing it, is not finding it, is still feeling discontent. So sinners, those of you who are looking for that and haven't found it, repent. Which doesn't mean get down on your knees and say, oh, I'm sorry, Lord, etc. The actual word, metanoia, is change your mind, change your thinking, change how you look at things. Because the kingdom of heaven, what you're looking for, is not out there, it is at hand. Not at hand in the sense of it's about to come in 20 years' time or 3 weeks' time. It's at hand in the sense of deeply close by, it's within you. And so this is the wisdom that I think so many teachers have come across. And then they feel the power of that and they start sharing it with people around them who start sharing it with others. But there's something that inevitably happens with the sharing of any teaching. You take, you know, somebody who's a wise person, they're obviously teaching people who are not quite as wise as them. That's why they're teaching them. And those people get it, but maybe they only get it 95%. And they pass that on to people who get 95% of that, who pass that on to people. It's a bit like taking a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. Gradually, it gets more blurred. Do that through generation after generation and from one culture to another, and then start translating it from one language into another, and then let it be absorbed by different cultures, and you end up with something that is often far removed from the original wisdom. And that was what I rejected as a kid. Was, you know, what had become of that spiritual wisdom, which I think is a universal wisdom that is found in all traditions and yet gets fossilized in often the exact opposite. And what shifted me was back then I started meditating. And at that stage I was interested in TM, Transcendental Meditation, and I was reading the books of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And he was saying how religion's got it all wrong. And here was a spiritual teacher saying religion's got it all wrong. It got it all inside out, that it's back to front, that you don't have to make an effort to meditate, that any effort, any trying whatsoever is going to get in the way. That meditation is that complete letting go, complete release. And this started fascinating me. So I left England, I went out to India, and studied meditation for a while. Lived in an ashram, then some other places. And that was the turning point for me. That's when I realized there was something to spirituality after all. But it wasn't what religion was telling me. But seeing there was a deep wisdom there about the nature of the human mind, how we get caught up in our wanting things, how we get caught up in a sort of egocentric mode of functioning, looking after ourselves primarily, and this whole thing about wanting things. I began to see that really what spirituality was about was a deep, deep psychological understanding of the human mind, which science hadn't got to yet. I mean, psychology is the youngest of the sciences. It's only 100 years old or so. It's a very, very new science. and it's still approaching it from the outside. But I realized that the real psychology was in the spiritual teachings. And it struck me then when I was living in India that this was what was missing. Really, I was going to say in the West, but in the whole world these days, we have this incredible knowledge about the external world, which Western science has given us, and very little knowledge about ourselves, how we work. And we've ignored that. Science has ignored consciousness, and in so doing, it's ignored all that wisdom that is there, which is what I think we really need today. We need that wisdom, because we have very, very powerful technologies which we're not using wisely. We don't have the values to know how to apply them. And what I realized was just about everything that was going wrong in the world, it came back to human consciousness, whether it was human decisions made short-sightedly or for self-centered reasons, greed, power hunger, or just purely people just looking after themselves, their own needs. Every single problem, in one way or another, there was this issue of human consciousness. And when we're faced with a problem, we look out, we try to solve the problem out there, whether it's, you know, the dying rainforest, poverty, malnutrition, climate change. We look out there. We don't look at what it is in terms of the human psyche that is creating these problems in the first place, and then not allowing us to solve them. So I came back when, in a sense, that was my mission ever since coming back from India, was to realize this is the most critical thing. How do we promote this awakening of consciousness? And this is what's happening through so many churches, movements. There's such a groundswell for this happening in the world today, particularly over the last few decades. This is really taking off, this deep inner search. How can we actually become more truly what we are? And at the same time, science is sort of sliding in sideways into this, not quite realizing where it's going. I think science is actually going to discover what the spiritual teachings have been on about all along and have called God, which science has so carefully rejected and put aside. And it comes back to this issue of consciousness and what is consciousness. And the problem that science has is, how does subjective experience, how does mind, which is not matter, I'm talking about experience, mind as experience, how on earth does that come out of dead matter? The basic assumption of our current scientific worldview is that the universe is composed of dead matter. There's no spirit there. It's just electrons, whatever, protons, atoms, molecules. There's no consciousness there. It's all dead, unconscious, inert matter. And then somehow in the human brain, and probably dogs' brains and dolphins' brains and snakes' brains, but somehow in the brain, something magic happens, and out of this dead, inert, unconscious matter, experience arises. And they're trying one way or another to explain it. But what's happening is this thread which has been developing the last 10 years or so, which is fascinating. And it's a growing number of philosophers and scientists. They're still small, but it's growing. I think this is where things are going. We're beginning to say, hang on, we're not questioning the fundamental assumption here. And the fundamental assumption is that the universe is made of dead matter, inert matter. That may be the stumbling block. And the alternative view, and the one I've become fascinated by and exploring, is to say, no, actually, everything is conscious. It's in everything. Now, this is almost anathema to standard science, but when you start taking that view that consciousness is in everything, the whole thing looks so much simpler. You don't have to explain how dead matter gives rise to experience. Everything is experiencing. We have a very rich experience because of our senses and our thinking and our feelings and all of that. It doesn't mean that an ant has the same sort of experience as we do, or a rock has the same experience. But that ability to have experiences there, everything has an inner world. An ant's inner world is probably much, much smaller than ours. A bacterium's inner world is very, very, almost nothing compared to ours. Its senses may just be a chemical sense of what's rubbing against its outer boundary of the cell. So, but what has evolved is not that matter has evolved and suddenly consciousness popped into existence by magic. Consciousness was always there, and as matter has evolved, so the consciousness has evolved along with it, so that now, with us, we have probably the richest consciousness on the planet. And we have reached this point where we can then reflect back into consciousness and study consciousness firsthand and begin to understand what consciousness is. So this is the fascinating thing that's happened. Consciousness has evolved through life on Earth to us at this point where we can say, hey, now we can begin to look back into consciousness and understand who we are, what we really are. And knowing that it's all of this is just happening in consciousness. And so this is where science is slowly drifting. And what it doesn't quite realize is what it's about to show is what all the great metaphysical and spiritual traditions have been on about for thousands of years, which science has rejected because they're just religion, and that's all about some external God out there looking over the universe, and we've disproved, we don't need a God out there to show how the universe functions. We haven't caught sight of him with our telescopes, or her, or it. And we look down into atoms, there's no divine beings down there. Basically, we're very proud to say we have got rid of God. We can explain the whole universe without God. Where they haven't looked is the mind. And that's where all the great teachings have discovered that's where the divine is. That the divine essence is our own essence. And that's why you see in so many traditions, one of the universal themes that comes up is, put its most blatant form, I am God. Now, you have to be very careful when you say that, because your loved will end up in a mental institution where they will give you drugs until they've dulled the mind so much that you no longer remember that you are God and you stop saying it. Because people totally misunderstood just about every single word in that sentence. And there's only three words. When someone says that, they may be deluded. They could be just thinking, I am the guy who did the whole thing. Hey, it's me, fellas. When that comes from the deep, deep experience, that experience is, this thing I call I, when we look at I, we think we know what I am. I am Peter Russell, blah, blah, blah. They're just the roles, the names, the things I do. I can go deeper. And I realize, I have feelings, but I'm not my feelings. What is the I? What is the I? And as you go deeper and deeper, and this is, classic meditation experience, you go deeper and deeper and deeper looking for what is this experience of I. You realize there's nothing there, no thing there, but just this sense of being. There is awareness, that awareness that is always there. There is consciousness. That's what's there the whole time, consciousness. And in that awareness, that's when you discover the peace. That's where you discover the love, that one is love. And all, just about every characteristic we've applied to the divine that it's unchanging, it's eternal, it's forgiving. All of those apply to that essence of I-ness. And so when people say, I am God, what they're really saying is that essence of I-ness is the divine as we make contact with it in ourselves. And that that divine is in everything. And so that is where I see the meeting of science and spirituality, is in that deep, deep inner experience. And when science begins to look at that, what is that experience really about? That's when I think we'll see the two coming together properly. And I see that's probably time to finish. So, thank you very much.